Okay, so tonight we'll be looking at Daniel chapter 5. I'd like to do just the quickest of review because I think there's something of a theme that we see developing in the presentation of these chapters. As we considered Daniel chapter 1 a month ago, the events that are revealed there in the first chapter take place in 606 to 603 B.C., which are the first 3 years that Daniel and his friends are in captivity after Nebuchadnezzar has completed and succeeded with his first invasion of Jerusalem, 606 B.C., some say 605. But in that chapter, Daniel and his friends are first captured, of course. One would think a very negative, unhappy sort of a thing. But we saw in our introductory material, Jeremiah had pointed out that this was also to rescue them. It is the saving of their lives. And while it is a captivity, they will also be treated well. They will be highly educated. They will also be pressed into service for Nebuchadnezzar. But those friends now prove themselves to be faithful. So really the great theme apparently of that chapter is when you are confronted with a threat to your faith, you simply remain faithful. And so they did, and in the process are proven not only faithful to their God, but superior to all of their peers in the kingdom. So they rise above them in wisdom and make a very deep impression then in a purely pagan society, in an idolatrous society, in a horrifically and hideously immoral society. Here are these three young men just standing firm and faithful and showing the world how to do it. Just like I think of that whole row right there that we need to leave Carolyn out. There were our young ones there. We just appreciate it. Okay, that's more. Here we go. There's a mess back in the corner there, too. Yeah, you young ones, you know, it's your turn. You're the up-and-comers. And these chapters are for you. Those of us that are older, you know, we have been through those years when all things that have to do with the flesh really are more tempting and more interesting. And yet these young men, of course, have proven themselves as you have, and we're just elated to have you here and setting that example now. Be faithful. Prove yourself superior. And in Daniel chapter 2, while the three friends are left out of the mix, we have exactly the same thing. Did you notice that the point of the chapter is to prove that Daniel is superior to all the wise men in the entire kingdom? And so, once again, there's a great comparison that's being made between those who are hoeing that row and hewing that line, you know, to be what God would have them be. Daniel is able then to interpret the kingdom's dream, the four kingdoms' dream, the terrifying dream that Nebuchadnezzar sees. And in his revelation, in the interpretation that God gives to Daniel, there are, or will be, we learn, four successive kingdoms beginning with Nebuchadnezzar's. But the point of it at the end, especially, is to introduce to us in the book of Daniel an eternal kingdom that is going to be very prominent throughout much of the rest of this book now. So it is first introduced in the vision, the dream, and then interpreted by Daniel. There's an eternal kingdom, a never-ending kingdom, that is on the way. So the four kingdoms of Babylon, and of course then the Medo-Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans will disappear. They will blow away like chaff in the wind. And for the first time then, though you have sort of an indication of it in the first chapter, Yahweh, the God of the Jews, what is often translated Jehovah today in English, but that God is extolled, is praised, honored by Nebuchadnezzar, this old pagan king, who's anything but faithful, you know, and upright, but he is wise enough to know when he sees superior forces at play, and he is able to give credit where credit is due. So at some length and forcefully, beautifully, Nebuchadnezzar pays tribute to the glory of our God. Daniel chapter 3 is more of the same. It's a different setting, but we're still dealing with young people forced into making that decision of whether or not they will yield to the culture that they live in. They choose, under the threat of death, and apparently about to meet their doom, to remain faithful even when they're thrown into the fire. They told the king, God may save us or he may not, but we're not going to abandon or desert him. So now Daniel's three friends are proven to be faithful. And again, Yahweh is extolled. Nebuchadnezzar steps up and gives praise and glory to God. It is encouraging, you know, to see this man and the influence that the younger men have had. What happens in Daniel 4? The same thing. We have again another troubling dream. We have again Daniel, the only wise man in the kingdom who can interpret it. He is superior then to everybody else with his insight that he has. And now when Yahweh is extolled yet again, this time it's at greater length. The chapter begins with Nebuchadnezzar saying that he wants to give praise to this superior God. It ends the same way, and again, this time again, for twice in the chapter, that eternal kingdom comes up. And so by the time you get to the fourth chapter, the two themes of the superiority of Yahweh and then this coming eternal kingdom are being amplified, actually doubled, in their presentation. And so, by the time you get to Daniel 4, one gets pretty convinced Daniel and his friends are faithful in the most adverse of circumstances. And God blesses them in the process. They rise to positions of great influence and are proving to these other people the superiority of our God, who is then praised and glorified for his power and for his qualities. What's going to happen tonight? This, by the way, is Rembrandt's famous painting of the handwriting on the wall. So in Daniel chapter 5, Daniel in this chapter will be rewarded for his ability, a third time now, to interpret what is not a dream this time, but is an actual physical, supernatural event. Y'all know about it. This is, you know, does as good a job as any of portraying the handwriting on the wall. And then Yahweh, after four chapters of establishing his superiority, will now punish the last of those Babylonian kings and will demonstrate now the truth of Daniel's interpretations of Nebuchadnezzar's dreams. And so then, by the end of the chapter, Babylon itself will fall. And so let's go ahead and read the chapter now. Grab your pencil right at the outset and put a date down, because thanks to several historians that I'll mention at the end of the class, we have records that are of great interest to us about the fall of Babylon, the fulfillment of Nebuchadnezzar's dream there and Daniel's prophecies at the end of the first kingdom that's in the dream of chapter 2. And so when it says in verse 1 of chapter 5 that Belshazzar, or Belshazzar the king, held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of the 1,000, this is, as a matter of fact, October of 539 B.C. So there seems to be some agreement among the historians of that general time frame that this event that we're going to be reading about took place in the month of October, and it would be 539 B.C. So make a little note right there that while you're at it, I did the same thing at verse 30. So whether you have the whole chapter as I do on facing pages, so I don't have to turn a page to see it or not, the event that takes place in verse 30, which is the death of Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, is taking place in October 539. So if you like, you might want to put it in both those locations. So what's the king doing? Well, he's doing what kings do. He is relishing and reveling in his kingness. It's good to be king. Joel. Yeah. Okay, this is a great question, and I want to thank you all for that. There's apparently one of those cases where we have a co-regency, and it has really caused problems for a lot of biblical students and commentators, because those that have a kind of lesser faith, I guess, you know, they're reading about this Belshazzar, and so the historical records for a long time, none had been found that mentioned him. So here we go again for the umpteenth time. You remember the whole series I did on Christian evidences, biblical evidences. You know, it's the same old story that's played out, I guess, hundreds of times, where the great wise men of any given age, you know, in America or any other country, you know, the archaeologists haven't found a record yet of some given king is named in Scripture. So clearly, you know, it must be that the Bible's totally wrong. It can't be that the archaeologists just have been, you know, vigorous enough with their shovels. So they just assume that because we haven't found anything yet, then there must not be anything to find. And so, Nabonidus is the name of the king that they did have records of for this time frame. Belshazzar was unknown until fairly recently, when then again, finally the shovel turned it over, and well, what do you know, there he is, and now he's actually popped up on more than one occasion. So we now also have ancient historical records for Belshazzar. But what's apparently happening is that Nabonidus is the father, Belshazzar is the son, and they are jointly ruling at this time. However, at this time, Belshazzar, that we're reading about, is the king that's in Babylon, and he's the king that Daniel's dealing with, so Daniel doesn't have any reason to be mentioning Nabonidus. Nabonidus is the father, Nabonidus still lives, and Nabonidus is still ruling, but it's a co-regency with his son, and his son is making all these mistakes here. So, does that answer your question, Cal? You know, it threw a curveball at everybody, but anybody, you know, who's learned from all the previous occasions where the archaeologists and historians and infidels, you know, decided that faithlessness was better than faithfulness, you know, trusted themselves over the biblical record and were proven wrong, inevitably. So there's no question about it now, you know, there is a Belshazzar, we've got historical records more than one place. So Belshazzar, the king, under Nabonidus' dad, but ruling jointly, holds this great feast. He's enjoying life. And so a thousand of his nobles, he's drinking wine in the presence of the thousand. Now, we'll have, as I said, some historical records at the end here. I'll be reading from a commentary about that. Now, once again, there was a lot of discussion for years and years and years about this event. What, did such a feast take place? Was Belshazzar, you know, doing such a thing? And as a matter of fact, it too seems to have been confirmed by these other historical writers. So, in the presence of a thousand, in verse 2, Belshazzar tasted the wine, gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, in order that the king and his nobles, his wives, his concubines, might drink from them. Now, don't let verse 2 throw you off, says Nebuchadnezzar his father. But the Jews did the same thing, and so did these people, and we kind of not so much. We're more specific about grandfather, great-grandfather, that kind of thing. Though we still do say the forefathers of our country, that sort of expression. It's not his immediate father, but he is in the succession there. And so they're using the term father in the sense of, you know, family. Nebuchadnezzar, we've read in this book, starting in Daniel chapter 1, look at verse 1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with what? These same vessels that we're talking about now in chapter 5. So Nebuchadnezzar, he pillaged, you know, a lot of these vessels, brought them back to Babylon, spoils of war, and Belshazzar now, he has access to them. So he has not desecrated them. He has not tried to humiliate the God of Israel by drinking out of these vessels until this time, but he's going to take the occasion now. So in order that the king and his nobles, his wives, his concubines might drink from them. In verse 3, they brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank the wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Suddenly, the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. So a miraculous, you know, appearance takes place. And it's physically observable. The plaster of the wall, positioned in such a manner that it's got perfect lighting to illustrate it. You notice how that was said about the lampstand. Begins carving in the wall what is four words. And so, writing opposite the lampstand, and he looks at the back of the hand. He can see it. Now, brethren, whether or not it's, you know, the same size as a typical man's hand, or it's a giant hand or whatever, you know, we're not told, but there the king, right before his very eyes, observes an apparition. And so he responds the way anybody would when suddenly there before your very eyes appears the impossible. Where's the body? And it just says a hand emerged. And apparently just out of thin air, but as if it was coming out, you know, through a curtain, he sees it. And so in verse 6, the king's face grew pale, his thoughts alarmed him, his hip joints went slack, his knees began knocking together. The picture there, I suppose, you know, Rembrandt shows, you know, the horror on the other people's faces and all that. But I don't think he just stood up and started knocking his knees together. And I think the poor guy is probably falling backwards and tripping over the table or who knows what. And his body has just gone out of control. He's in terror. And so all these different expressions are used to show that he's just staggering and stumbling and weak. He's lost control of himself because he's just terrified by this vision that he is beholding. And so then, in verse 7, the king called aloud to bring in the conjurers, the Chaldeans, and here we go again. So there's this class of advisors who are occult advisors as well as just, you know, simple wise men, but the full gamut that you'd have at your disposal. And so he spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me will be clothed with purple and have a necklace of gold around his neck and have authority as third ruler in the kingdom. So, you know, those are great blessings and honor and reward. And he'll be, in verse 7 here, Cal asked a moment ago, he'll be third in the kingdom. So, Cal, what did we just learn about the kings? Who is the actual father, Nabonidus, who would be co-ruler but would have really lesser power, Belshazzar. So when he says, Daniel, you know, you didn't know it's Daniel yet, but whoever does this is going to be third, what position did he give? The next one, the highest one that he had the power to give without dethroning himself. There's a bit of a confirmation just in that statement. If he was the only king, what would be the highest position he could give? Number two. He doesn't. He says three. Well, that's because there are two that are, you know, ahead. So, in verse 7, here's the deal. If you can read it and explain it, clothed with purple, necklace of gold, authority as third, you're going to be riding high. So when they, all the king's wise men came in, I must have been eager and bustling, you know, well, let's get some of this, but they could not read the inscription or make known its interpretation to the king. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed. His face grew paler. His nobles were perplexed. This guy is next door to passing out now. This is bad. What does that mean? And you'd be just as distressed. You know, this is supernatural. It's therefore awfully important. And I can't figure out what it means. Is it great reward or is it doom? You know, what is it? So in 10, we got a wise queen The queen entered the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his nobles. You can imagine the upset in the whole palace. The queen spoke and said, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is a spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of your father, illumination, insight, and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge, and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now you're noticing the similarities right here. The Shazzar part means protection. Bel is their idol, that's the god. And I'm not sure, you know, there's hardly any difference between these two, so I don't know if there's some kind of significance in that that God was working toward. But Belshazzar and Belteshazzar, you know, have extremely similar names. So now he's being told, there's a guy who's renowned, bearing even a similar name to yours. Let Daniel now be summoned. He'll declare the interpretation. So in 13, Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel who is one of the exiles from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? Now I've heard about you, that a spirit of the gods is in you, and that illumination, insight, and extraordinary wisdom have been found in you. Just now, the wise men and the conjurers were brought in before me that they might read this inscription and make its interpretation known to me. But they could not declare the interpretation of the message. But I personally have heard about you, that you are able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you're able to read the inscription and make its interpretation known to me, you will be clothed with purple and a necklace of gold around your neck. You'll have authority as the third in the kingdom. Now, let's stop here for a few minutes. That's an awful lot of really high praise for Daniel, isn't it? And he says, the king says, I've heard about you. Well, we were just told, how did he hear about it? From the queen. But I would like, you know, just to ask, does that mean that when the queen mentioned Daniel, Belteshazzar, and, you know, the name that had been given by Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar, that he was still, after she spoke, going, huh, never heard of him before? Or could it be that when she said that, he would go, oh, you know, I remember that. I should think that Daniel, who has been in captivity for how many years? Now figure this out. If it was 606 to 603, and now we're at 539, how many years are we talking about here? Well, in round numbers, it's the 70, isn't it? 539 plus 70, 70 would be 609. He's been in captivity then for how long? 67 years, you know, if you go from the 67 to 70 years, he's right there. So, this is the entire lifetime of this king, isn't it? And for the generations preceding, would they not remember how Nebuchadnezzar ate grass? Would they not tell this family story? Well, who was involved in that story? Daniel was involved in this story. Had he supposed, do you suppose, never heard about Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the four kingdoms and we're the head of gold? He never heard about this. You know, he got some kind of education before he came to the throne. And so, in my opinion at least, you know, I suggest to you that while in his terror, with his knees knocking, do you do your best thinking at that time? I've been afraid a few times. I had you get here some years ago. I never forgot. I think it's the most scared I've ever been in my whole life. I was high up on a ladder, up against a tree, working for my next door neighbor, an elderly lady who couldn't do such things, you know, and so I was up in this tree and trimming, you know, and doing some work for her. And sure enough, I just, you know, wasn't paying attention. And I let my balance get back far enough that that ladder suddenly rocked back away from the trunk of that tree. There came space between it. The shot of adrenaline I took right then must have been a full gallon. I'm telling you, I still feel it. You know, now, what kind of philosophical problems and historical information is going through my mind in this? In this moment of terror? Well, none. You know, it was just so debilitating. And then it was just, you know, might and fortune that the thing fell back against the tree again. So it doesn't surprise me that the first thing that comes to his mind is not Daniel. So I just don't want us to think he'd never heard of it. It probably, the queen, you know, mentions this, and then there's confirmation in him. So when he says all this about him, you know, she says in 10 and 11 and 12, this lengthy description of Daniel. It's just beautiful. People would describe me like this. But then Daniel was brought in, and the king said, "Are you that Daniel?" And he adds stuff that doesn't seem to be in her discussion, at least not what's recorded. And so, I've heard about you, probably his whole life. Now, Wiseman can't do it, but in 16, I personally, again, he says, I've heard about you. So twice he says, I've heard about you. Daniel answers now in verse 17. And he said before the king, "Keep your gifts for yourself or give your rewards to someone else. However, I will read the inscription to the king and make the interpretation known to him." So why did Daniel do that? Why did he say keep the rewards? Bill?
Because he's just doing God's bidding and he doesn't need to be rewarded for it.
See, I can think of a couple of reasons, and that's chief among them. How often, brethren, do you even in the New Testament see that somebody will work a miracle and then folks will misunderstand, you know, you're a god, you're Hermes, you know, we have these problems. And so there's this wisdom and humility, you know, in saying that it's really not in me, so keep your gifts. There's also, you know, him demonstrating I'm not in it for the money. You know, this is between you and God, is what he's establishing. I think Bill's nailed it right there. And so it's just apparently a wise thing to do, to give credit where credit is due. And by the way, how did Nebuchadnezzar wind up eating grass? Because he took the credit for himself. How did apparently Moses wind up not going into the promised land? God specifically said, "You didn't honor me the way you were supposed to." Okay, so Daniel's a smart man, and he's been reading the prophets, and so he demonstrates the humility that he's learned from the Old Testament, seen in Moses' failure, and also learned, you know, firsthand in Nebuchadnezzar's experience. So he says, I don't need the stuff, but I'll tell you what it says. Now in 18, he begins, "O king, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar, your father." Now, I want to be careful here. You know, kind of always of two minds. A moment ago, I was saying this old pagan king, you know, and Nebuchadnezzar, and, you know, kind of in the sense of putting the guy down. How does Daniel portray him? Sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty. The man deserves a lot of honor. And after all, because what does verse 18 say is the source of these things? Nebuchadnezzar is an impressive figure in world history. Outside the pages of the Bible, Nebuchadnezzar is an impressive figure. In all these things, the sovereignty, the grandeur, the glory, and the majesty came from whom? Came from God. So it must have been pretty impressive. All four of them, they came from the Lord God of heaven. That's how he got the position that he was in. 19. And because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, and languages feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished, he killed. Whomever he wished, he spared alive. Whomever he wished, he elevated. And whomever he wished, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne, and his glory was taken away from him. Now, I've said time and again, he kind of come to like Nebuchadnezzar. Here's more evidence and reason why. We've just been told all these good things. His glory was handed to him by God. Now, note, though, in 20, when his heart was lifted up and his spirit became so proud that he became arrogant, he was deposed. What does that tell you about the time before his heart was lifted up and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly? Was there a time when he was not guilty of those three things? That seems to be the implication of the passage, doesn't it? God gave him all these things, and apparently for a time, apparently for years, he handled it properly. He was not arrogant. He was not conceited. He did not misbehave. But when he succumbed, did these things, then he got in trouble with his God. So there's a lot to commend this man. He was doing a good job, apparently, at least an acceptable one in the sight of God. But when his heart was lifted up, suggesting it hadn't been at first, when his spirit became so proud, it hadn't been at first, then he behaved arrogantly, which he hadn't been doing, then he lost the glory and the throne. So in 21, he was also driven away from mankind. His heart was made like that of beasts. His dwelling place was with the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind, and that he sets over it whomever he wishes. Now, again, I commend Cal. He wrote me a letter I got today, an email, discussing this verse and its reference back to chapter 4, the preceding chapter from last week, and asking about how long the times were. I don't know how long the times were. I told you last week. Most people think they were years. Maybe they were. I think, it doesn't say years. It says times. So I don't know exactly how long a time is, but it was long enough for this to happen. His body is drenched with the dew, dwelling place with wild animals, eaten like cattle. But what did we learn from the previous chapter about his hair and his nails? Like bird's feathers and claws. Okay? So it was a long period of time. It was a very significant period of time. And it was most impressive then for the kingdom to recognize that the guy had lost his mind. But look at the last part of that verse. Until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind, he sets it over whomever he wishes. Nebuchadnezzar said that twice in the last chapter. He said it as a preface to the chapter. Then he told the story how he figured that out, and said it again at the end. And so, again, Nebuchadnezzar did well, did poorly, and then what? Did well again. Repented of it, learned his lesson, and got back to business the way God would have him take care of business. So he says, though, in 22, yet you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you what? Knew all this. Well, I told you earlier. Highly unlikely you wouldn't know. And now what are we told by inspiration? He knew all of that. He just was not of the same caliber. He was just not made of the right stuff. as is so often the case when you're inheriting a kingdom that you know you haven't earned, or maybe walking into a promised land that you know you didn't build the houses and all that. This is just a problem, you know, when you're an inheritor that you haven't fought for, you didn't learn the hard way, you don't place as high a value on it. And so he got the education, he knew these things, but he didn't get the education either, did he? So in 23, but you've exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. You and they brought the vessels of his house before you. And you, your nobles, your wives, and your concubines have been drinking wine from them. You praise the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see, hear, or understand. But the God in whose hand are your life, breath, and your ways, you have not glorified. This is very interesting. What was God's expectation for this Gentile pagan king? In the last part of that verse, what should that king have been doing? And there's no excuse for his failure. That has God ever abandoned or kept himself from other nations besides the Jews? And does God not hold accountable all those nations and their kings? Even though they didn't have Moses' law, were not in a covenant relationship with God like the Jews were. Does that free them from God's expectation that they recognize the God of heaven as the God of heaven and earth, who, at the end of verse 21, is ruler over the realm of mankind and sets over it whomever he wishes? These kings were given plenty enough information, and a fair amount of it had come through what four guys? Daniel and his friends in the last 70 years, 67 to 70 years. You should have known better. Because you should have known better, you're going to answer for it. So, look what you've done. Look at this. It's just the worst kind of dishonor that you paid to God. This is blasphemy of the highest order. And it, you know, you have, in such a vulgar manner, profaned those pure and holy utensils that were used in the service of God. And so, here you are, praising the gods of silver, gold, and stone, etc., and just drinking wine out of those vessels. You're in trouble. So 24, then, the hand was sent from him, and this inscription was written out. Now this is the inscription that was written out. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin, which is apparently a compound word. This is the interpretation of the message. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. And that word was repeated. Tekel, you've been weighed on the scales and found deficient. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and Persians. Now, brethren, if you look up on the screen here, let me show you this next chart. It is a little bit confusing, you know, as to what was on the wall. Aramaic is what it sounds like. Aramaic is the lingua franca of the people of that time. What language is this chapter written in? Aramaic. We talked about that, starting with chapter 2, verse 4. And so, those are the Aramaic words. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin is four words, but apparently these last two words on the chart were combined into a single word, so this word was repeated twice and this one and this one. But the question is that, you know, if the hand writes Aramaic on the wall, you know, everybody speaks Aramaic, how come they don't know what it says? You know? So it throws it kind of a loop, don't you? You got a thought? Yeah, no, I'm sorry, I thought you raised your hand there. I just caught it out of the corner of my eye. But, you know, so, well, maybe it wasn't Aramaic. I mean, it was something else. Or maybe it was written in a manner that, you know, was illegible. Or maybe they're not actually talking about whether or not we can read the words, but what does it mean? And maybe a third possibility is somebody who doesn't speak Aramaic, if they can read it and tell me what it means, then I'll take it from them too. I mean, I don't care. So it caused people all kinds of consternation, but we weren't there. It made perfect sense then. And I don't need to know why they couldn't just read it themselves. I don't know. But even if they could, interpreting it would still be another matter. And as the chart shows, it still is. We have an inspired interpretation. We know what it means. But now we're looking at it, and you go, oh, I understand now why those words meant what they mean according to the interpretation, which I needed to understand it, but now I see it. So mena, as you can see on the chart, is actually derived from the word for mina, which is a coin, and it has to do with money. And so a mina, 60 gold shekels, etc. But it also means, you know, to number or to count, which you're always doing when you're talking about money. It's always about numbers and counting. Okay, and then the other word, the second word, Aramaic spelling of shekel. Tekel, you can hear it. You know how in different languages, you know, they have different forms, but usually there's similarities you can recognize. And again, you can recognize shekel here. But a shekel was not so much a thing you counted as a measurement of weight. So shekels, it, you know, is like an ounce or pound. That it's a measurement of silver or gold or whatever. Okay, and then we have the plural form, the half, minas, and teres down here, and they're put together, you know. But notice this last part right here. Most of the commentators think, and at least, you know, we can see this, so it's intriguing, it raises the question. This last part, this upharsin, well, you know, it means to divide or to cut or to break apart, so we get that. But this last part of this compound word is also the root word for Persia. Persia. So now look at the interpretation. So 124, the hand was sent from him. This inscription was written out. This is the inscription that was written. Mena, Mena, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of the message. Mena, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. Tekel, you've been weighed on the scales and found deficient. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and what? Given to the Persians. See? So they may have been able to read the words, but the words themselves could carry different ideas. Are we talking about the coin or are we talking about the number? Are we talking about, you know, the volume? Are we talking, you know, the weight? Are we talking about, you know, Persians, or are we talking about, you know, something being torn apart? And so you can see why he might have been especially fearful, because he could understand some of it. And now he's saying, what does that mean? Okay? Can you get now how it might have been really scary? He's going, counted, weighed, broken apart, Persia. Now, in a little bit, you're going to find out there's some real good reason for him to go, what's that about Persia? Okay? We'll come to that in just a minute. Let's just finish the chapter and do it. In verse 29, then Belshazzar gave orders. They clothed Daniel with purple, put the necklace of gold around his neck, issued a proclamation concerning him. He now had authority as third ruler of the kingdom. So he probably signed the document. You know, he handed it to David. He's going to publish it. But in 30 and 31, that same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. And then, let the games begin. Because we all know if an archaeologist hasn't found it, then it can't have happened. So here we go again. There's just all kinds of, you know, problems
with Darius. Who's Darius? Now, friends, if you learn anything about biblical kings or any other king, do kings, you know, only have one name? It's rare to have only one name. And do kings not also sort of collect names as time goes by? They get all kinds of honorary titles and whatnot, you know, that also show up. And so it's not unusual at all that a particular name could represent a king whose name we do know in the uninspired historical records that have been discovered, that paltry small number that actually come to light. You know, there's no reason to think here that there's some kind of giant problem because, you know, the name Darius hasn't cropped up here, there, and everywhere. So that's problem number one. Let me also, which is not a problem at all. But the next thing is, you know, thinking about these Persians here, please note in 30 and 31, Daniel said you're going to die tonight. And he did. Do you read here about any battle? Do you read here, you know, about the hand of an assassin? Do you read anything about how he died? No, you don't. It's pretty thin, isn't it? Yeah, it is. But it's also kind of noticeable. Really, brethren, usually there's only three ways that anybody stops being a king. They die from natural causes. Or number two, they die from what kind of cause? They get killed. It's good to be king until somebody kills you, which is often the case. It's kind of just that. It's good to be king until the end. And then, what's the third way? You die naturally, you get killed by an assassin who was sitting at your table, or you get dethroned by an invading army. Okay. So 30 and 31, that same night, Daniel's book tells us that a king who they couldn't find in the historical record killed him somehow. He died that night. Now, what I'm going to do here, I just want to read a couple of paragraphs from a commentary that came out in 1949 by Edward Young, by everybody's estimation. This is one of the best commentaries you could possibly own on Daniel. He makes a huge number of mistakes in it, but nonetheless, his scholarship, is great. His doctrinal understanding of Scripture can be pretty poor, but, you know, his historical stuff is fabulous, so it always is a two-edged sword, but Edward Young's commentary on Daniel, you know, is worth having. And there's a little deal here at the very end that I just thought was so well done that I'm just going to read it all together. So it starts off, it says verse 30, and then in italics, he quotes that portion he's going to talk about. And that night was Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, slain. So he says, Hauer maintains, another commentator, that the powerful catastrophe mentioned in this verse is unhistorical. What powerful catastrophe that's mentioned in that verse? You see a powerful catastrophe in this verse? I see one guy dies. That's all I see. Now, that's a catastrophe for him, but it's a powerful catastrophe. So he says, but this verse does not speak of a powerful catastrophe unless the murder of the king in itself is regarded as such. Now here we go. According to Herodotus, Cyrus, this is a contemporary historian, Cyrus was a long time in preparing for the siege of Babylon. Now, it's not Darius, that's Cyrus, but these two get linked together. Cyrus was a long time preparing for the siege of Babylon, and the Babylonians advanced to meet him. They left the city to do battle. Being worsted, so they win or lose the battle, those Babylonians. They lost it. They retreated and shut themselves up in their city. Finally, Cyrus diverted the waters of the Euphrates so that his troops could cross the shallow water. The city fell when a festival was being celebrated. I read this and it piqued my interest, so I went online. It's easy to find. I got Herodotus' history, read the whole passage, you know, and exactly what it says. Very fascinating information about how the Euphrates River was diverted by Cyrus in the better portion of a year after the Babylonians had lost their one attempt to do battle outside the walls, and now they had retreated where they had food and water for years and years and years and years and years to come. They thought, no problem, let's wait them out. That's Herodotus. Xenophon, another historian, mentions the deflecting of a stream which flowed through Babylon. So now both of them have talked about the city fell because the river got diverted. Finally, when the Babylonians were observing a night festival with drinking and revelry, both of them say there was a big drunken party going on. Cyrus turned aside the course of the river and entered the city. The entrance was made by Gobryas, who entered the palace and slew the wicked king. Xenophon represents the Babylonians as being extremely hostile to Cyrus. Berosus, now he cites a third historian, relates that Nabonidus, who's that? Belshazzar's daddy. Nabonidus met the approaching Cyrus and, being defeated, fled to Borsippa. So Nabonidus wasn't in Babylon. When he lost that battle a year ago, he went to a different city. Who went to Babylon? Belshazzar. That's where Daniel is. Cyrus then captured Babylon and raised its walls. Nabonidus surrendered also at the other city and was sent to Carmenia, where he died in exile. Now, my time is just almost up. We've got about 1 minute. Here comes the fourth of these historians. The Nabonidus Chronicle mentions that in the month Tishri, that's October, Cyrus fought and destroyed the people of Akkad at Ophis on the Tigris River. On the 14th day, he captured Sippar without fighting. Nabonidus fled. On the 16th day, Gobryas, the governor of Gudium, and the troops of Cyrus, without fighting, entered Babylon. No battle mentioned on the day the city fell. Cyrus also, in the Cyrus Cylinder, states that he entered Babylon without encounter or battle. Now, timing's perfect. What do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different historical records say? Well, among them, several of them mention there was a drunken revelry going on. They also mention the diverting of the river. And they mention that there was not a big battle going on when the city fell. All of which are what, when you look at Daniel, last two verses of chapter 5, 30 and 31. It's exactly what happened. That's why Daniel's record doesn't mention a powerful catastrophe. But it does mention the drunken revelry. And then we learn the explanation was that Cyrus apparently spent months with his troops diverting the river. And then when he was done with all of that engineering work, they were able to walk across what had been a great natural barrier and were able to enter the city easily, and then they just found everybody rolling, stinking drunk. So what they did? Bye-bye. We're in charge. There's no fight. Everybody's wasted. You know, so they just surrendered and took over. It's always interesting, brother, how did people fight, you know, over how Daniel just can't be true. And then every time, they either discover the information, or we find the corroborating evidence, you know, which just shows it's never been incorrect at all. So, fascinating little chapter. And now, I guess you can get it. The poor guy looks up and he sees words that he probably half understands. And the last one says Persia. And how did he get to his drunken revelry? Because Persia beat them about a year ago, or 6 or 8 months, whatever it was. And now we're just lounging around drinking and doing nothing because we're locked inside the city while they don't realize what's happening to the river and Daniel's prophecy is fulfilled. And all of that had been going on. So when the handwriting shows up, Daniel said, oh, tonight's the night. So how long do you get to wear his purple? Until morning. But then we'll find out what happens between him and Cyrus. See how long it does last. Comment or question? Thanks for a couple of minutes.